The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect welcomes Dr. Bruce Blumberg, a PhD in biology at the University of California at Irvine. He has coined the term obesogen to describe chemicals in the foods that we eat that make us fat. Welcome to the show, Dr. Blumberg.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I read about you in an article in the Globe and Mail that made the case that I think is your case, that what makes us fat is not as obvious as calories in, calories out, but there are substances in our food that tilt our metabolism towards condition that makes us fat. Is that correct?
I would say that's a fair statement. So our work has established that there are a class of environmental chemicals that we call obesogens, and that exposure to these chemicals can make animals become fat despite eating a normal diet.
Oh, okay.
So our animals don't eat high-fat, high-sugar diets. They eat normal mouse food,
okay. Just
like their unexposed relatives.
Right.
And the exposed animals get heavier than the unexposed animals.
Okay. So this has been tried with mice. Has it been tried with other animals? And are there other animals that would better depict this dilemma?
Well, so similar experiments have been done with rats.
Right.
And they've been done with fish.
Right.
We've done them also with frogs.
Okay.
There are other research models that could be used, of course.
All right.
That depends on the interest of the people doing the experiments and the amount of budget available, because as you go to other animals, like, for example, primates,
yeah,
the experiments become very, very expensive.
Yeah.
Well, specialized.
Yeah, the ethical concerns as well. Well, you've identified these substances before you did the experiments so that you could apply them in the experiments. What are the substances that you've identified, broadly speaking?
So the one we've worked with mostly is the chemical called tributyltin. It's a kind of chemical called an organotin.
Okay.
And these chemicals are used in agriculture as fungicides and as miticides.
Oh.
They're used in paints as fungicides. They're used in various kinds of plastics, as heat stabilizers. They used to be painted on the bottom of ship hulls to make marine invertebrates not grow there.
Right. Is it freely used in these other applications that you spoke of? Is it still freely used in plastics? Is it still freely used otherwhere in that people would eat it or be exposed to it internally?
So, as far as I'm aware, organotins are still very widely used in and essentially unrestricted in their use in PVC plastics, polyvinyl chloride plastics.
Oh, okay. And I haven't heard a warning about PVC plastics. I mean, we've all been up in the air about bisphenol A, but PVCs in particular, no. So
no one's talking about that, about PBT yet.
Wow. Okay. What do you think is the mechanism by which they work? Do you have any clue? You must.
Well, so different obesogens work in different ways.
Oh.
So the one for which we understand the most about the mechanism is tributyltin.
Okay.
And tributyltin works through a hormone receptor which has a very horrible name, peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma.
Wow.
We can call it PPAR gamma. And this particular receptor controls the development of fat cells.
Oh.
When you activate the receptor, you convert pre-fat cells into fat cells.
And how did nature intend this to work?
PPAR gamma, its expression and activity affects the development of fat cells. It's designed by nature to control fat cells. I mean, we need fat cells in order to live.
So what was it designed to respond to? Obviously not these man-made chemicals.
Ah, that's a good question. So we're not quite sure what the natural hormone is.
Right.
There's some evidence that says long-chain fatty acids, other, let's say, nitrated versions of long-chain fatty acids. But that's still a little bit up in the air.
Oh, okay. But we're getting chemicals that affect these receptors from our manufactured articles now.
Yeah.
And it's making us fat. You suspect, you said that other obesogens work in a way, work in different ways. So do you suspect any other particular body pathways for these? And would that lead you to, well, it must. I mean, you're starting, you can't just start with the substances, what you call obesogens. You have to start with the effects and track it back, don't you?
That depends on how you've done the experiment, right? So there's some evidence that says a particular chemical at low doses makes an animal fat.
Okay.
You can track that backwards.
Okay.
One thing that we do is we test suspect chemicals in cells and ask, can this chemical make a cell become a fat cell in culture?
Oh, okay.
And if it does, and that's how we found tributyl-10, then after we knew that, we were justified to ask, what does it do to animals? And we don't like to kill animals needlessly.
Yeah.
So it's better if you have evidence first and then test it in the animals rather than just screening chemicals in animals.
So this is something we're already aware of, but because we're not aware of all the ramifications, this is a growing awareness.
Yes, it's a growing awareness.
And it's a growing effect.
By and large, still believes the calories in, calories out model.
Yeah.
And there's really a lot of evidence that says it's much more to it than that.
What kind of evidence can you tell us about?
Well, so this is not my evidence, but there was a very interesting book published a few years ago by Gary Taubes called Good Calories, Bad Calories.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And Taubes traces the evolution of nutritional policy.
All right.
And cites lots of studies in there where all of the conventional wisdom that we're taught,
yeah,
eat less fat,
right,
and to eat more carbohydrate,
right,
or to exercise more,
yeah,
that these studies have all been done in humans, and they don't make people thin.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good sign there's something else
at
work.
The other thing that argues against the calories in, calories out model, so most, and I've been lectured by senior people in the field saying that it's all a matter of thermodynamics, and it's,
yeah,
the number of calories that go in minus the number of calories that you burn,
right,
minus the number of calories that come out in the feces, and anything that's not accounted for there, you must have stored.
All right.
But different calories have different metabolic fates.
Yeah.
So a calorie of glucose has a different metabolic fate than a calorie of fructose, which is a very similar sugar.
Okay.
So there are no data to support that model, yet we keep hearing it.
What, the model, the calories in, calories out model?
It's the number and not the nature of calories.
Yeah, but already we hear rumblings about fructose being more fattening than glucose, for instance.
Yeah, but we're eating less fat than we did 20 years ago, and we're twice as fat,
yeah,
as a population.
Yeah, so we're obviously eating the wrong stuff. Are we far enough along this curve of understanding what obesogens are to identify changes in diet or food that we should stay away from and food that we should embrace, or is this still emerging?
Well, it's still emerging, but you can certainly make some recommendations and some modifications that will be beneficial.
Yeah.
So lowering your exposure to obesogenic chemicals is always a good idea.
Yeah.
Not simply because they're only obesogenic, but most of them are what we call endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So they have other effects besides.
All right.
Bisphenol A is an obesogen,
right.
But much of the adverse effects of bisphenol A are other than obesogenic effects.
Right. Okay.
So if you stop taking in bisphenol A because you want to get rid of the obesogenic effects, you'll at the same time get rid of the other effects.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
And I would say it's the same way with tributyltin. It's the same way with phthalates. It's the same way
really?
With parabens.
Really?
So there are lots and lots of chemicals that we're better off without.
Really? You must have awareness of or even have created a website about this that would interest the person who is listening?
No, I would say that I haven't done that because that takes more time than I have. I'm busy
I understand.
Trying to run my lab and fund the work that we're doing. That's a full-time job.
Are there other activists who have done this work?
There must be.
All right.
Could I point you to one that I've looked at and said, I agree with this? No, I can't.
Okay. So,
but it's the same kind of advice that applies to health in general. Less chemicals, the better.
Yeah, I suppose.
The farther down on the food chain, the better off you are.
Yeah.
The more organic, the better off you are.
Yeah.
And with regard to the nature of foods, I respectfully disagree with public health authorities who say that carbohydrate is our friend and we should eat 9 carbohydrates a day.
Right.
I don't think that there's any data to support that.
Right. Well, the public health people have set up a model of servings that is very hard for people who want to control their diet to understand. I mean, I think a serving of some things equates to what fits in the palm of your hand, whether it's a size size 10 hand or what. And if you follow their advice, you probably – I haven't even bothered to total it because it looks so – to me, it looks ridiculous. You come up with, 150 servings of different things during the day, that you're supposed to incorporate into your meals.
Right. I mean, you would think that such recommendations are based on research, and if Taubes is right, they're not.
Oh.
They're based on people just deciding.
Okay.
People with credentials.
I see. Okay.
Who have the best of intentions.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But, if eating less fat and exercising more was the solution to the obesity epidemic, then over the last 20 years, when we've done just that, we would be getting thinner and not fatter.
Yeah, that's true.
So the model is broken and needs to be reassessed.
So in your mind, then, without asking you for proof of it, it's probably fair to say that your characterization of the villain in this scenario is the industrialization of food processing.
I'm not sure if I would say that's a villain, but it certainly isn't helping us. But if I ate lots and lots of organic grains and sugars, I'd be slightly more healthy, but still fat. So whether it's organic sugar versus industrially prepared sugar, too much sugar is still a bad thing.
Right.
And if you now add the issue of obesogens that change how your body responds to these excess calories,
right?
And that's what we believe is happening, that obesogens are adjusting metabolism so that we're more likely to store the calories than to burn them.
Is there significant interaction with the insulin mechanism?
There probably is, but that's not been demonstrated yet.
Okay. This one's for all of you. Lyle Lovett in Skinny Legs.
See that boy with that guitar? He got skinny legs, like I always wanted a girlfriend in this car. Cause he's got skinny legs, like I always wanted. My sister, look at me again. Well, you'd love me if I were as skinny as him. And I see that boy with that guitar. He got a shirt and tie like I always wanted. A girlfriend in this car. Cause he's got a shirt and tie like I always wanted. My sister, look at me again. Well, you'd love me if I were a dresser like him. And see that boy with that guitar? He got a blue Toyota like I always wanted. A Japanese girl in his car. It's a blue Toyota like I always wanted. My sister, look at me again. Well, you'd love me if I were a driver like him. Baby face like I always wanted. A girlfriend in this car, cause he's got a baby face like I always wanted. My sister, look at me again. Well, you'd love me if I were a looker like him. And I see that boy with that guitar. He got a little round like I always wanted. A girlfriend in this car, cause he's got a little round like I always wanted. My sister, look at me again. You'd love me if I had what like you. You'd love me if that were my real name. But legs they come in and faces go, just like old Toyotas. A Jap girl dumped my ass and stole my clothes. She took my car and left me singing. You see that boy with that guitar? He got skinny legs like I always wanted. Skinny legs like I always wore.
It sounds like the examination, the experiment is open on very many broad fronts, and you have set yourself a Herculean task in attacking a few that look like better bets than the others. It sounds like you want more help in this field.
Well, the Herculean task came, 7 or 8 years ago when I was trying to convince anyone that this work was worth funding. And we're
okay.
able to do that. And
okay.
now we've actually come so far as the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences hosted a symposium, a 3-day symposium, a year ago, bringing together all the latest experts in this field to ask, what's the state of the evidence? What should we do going forward?
And did they reach conclusions that you favor?
Yeah, well, the obvious conclusion is that we need more research.
I guess it's hard to go against that. What can we expect from the research that you know is taking place?
What I know is coming out is that there are more obesogens.
Right.
We're learning more about mechanism.
Right.
And there will be some data coming in the next half a year to a year about whether or not these effects can be transmitted to subsequent generations.
Oh, that's frightening. Okay. So we'll know in the coming year.
I would say within the coming year, yeah. Some of these are papers that we're working on, and some of them are things I've heard from colleagues at meetings that I know they're working on.
So they're potentially genetic changes, too.
Epigenetic changes.
Okay. And how does an epigenetic change differ from genetic change?
Genetic change means that you change the sequence of the DNA.
All right.
That's the classic paradigm of the DNA's been mutated.
All right.
Right. So the gene has changed.
All right.
An epigenetic change does not change the sequence of the DNA, but it changes when and where and to what level the gene is expressed.
Okay.
Which actually isn't much different. So if you take a gene and you mutate it so that the protein doesn't work, or you turn it off,
yeah,
epigenetically, the same effect, you get the same effect, a gene that's not functioning.
Yeah, but I'm glimpsing a difference in meaning that applies to your supposition there may be generational changes. If you change a gene, that does not necessarily mean the changes will be passed on. But if you change its expression, that's more likely to be passed on. Is that true?
It's the case that epigenetic changes can be passed on.
Okay. All right.
They're not always passed on, but they can be.
Okay.
So it's a way that the environment and the chemicals we're exposed to, and the foods we eat, and the way that we live our lives can be passed on to our offspring.
For better.
And not so many years ago, no one would have thought that was the case.
Yeah. for better or for worse. I guess, you know, epigenetic changes probably evolved to enable us to cope with changing environments. But now that we're changing...
That's the idea.
Now we're changing our environment. They're tracking our changes, too.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah. So we're doing it to ourselves. Okay. What would you say to people who are concerned about this and want to follow up on it and make the changes in their own life as the evidence becomes clear? Where would they follow the work? Google?
Well, Google is a good way to follow what's happening out there in the scientific community. It's, you know, there's a lot of things on the internet, good and bad.
Sure.
Everyone with a website is now an authority.
Right.
And some of those are authorities, and some of those are...
Journals would be a better way to track this.
Yeah, I would
obviously.
Say scientific journals and the popular science versions of those journals are quite good.
Okay.
You know, the ones that make the science understandable for a non-technical audience.
Right. Right. Well, I want to say that I've found that the abstracts for these experiments and their results are often understandable, too. They're very...
I think so. We try to.
Okay,
and
good.
Shows like the Nature of Things program that was just shown in Canada last week, I was very impressed with how that worked.
Oh, what
I mean,
was it?
That film crew came and spent a few days with us.
Oh, really?
A year ago, and, you know, didn't know what to expect.
Oh,
and I was
okay.
Very pleased with the outcome of that show.
What was it called? The Nature of Things was the show, and what was the episode?
Oh, you didn't say it. So the show is The Nature of Things. It's a Canadian broadcasting company.
Okay.
And the episode, let me get the name of it, was just on last Thursday.
All right. Well, it's maybe available on the web.
I thought that maybe that's that you had heard about that, and that's why you were contacting me.
No, I probably picked it up secondhand. The newspapers picked it up.
Okay, so the newspaper picked up...
On the TV show,
something
probably.
Something, the PR from the show.
Probably.
And the show was called Programmed to be Fat.
Okay. All right.
And it's about the science related to obesogens and work from my lab and from several other labs and laying out the evidence such as it is.
Okay.
And they did a really good job of being balanced, not being hysterical, saying, this is what we know, this is what we reasonably infer, and this is what we still need to know.
All right.
So I highly recommend that.
Yeah, okay. CBC, and it was called again Programmed to be Fat. Is that right? It was called Programmed to be Fat?
Yes, Programmed to be Fat. This is the show called The Nature of Things with David Suzuki.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well,
familiar. Great show.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't get it here. So
really?
You have to look at the web.
Oh, okay. I have a feeling that many of those episodes are available on the web through the CBC.
I've seen a few of them.
Okay.
But they're not... At least in California, I can say it's not a regularly scheduled program on any of the cable channels that I can tune into if I want.
Yeah. Okay, follow it on the TV, follow it on the web. Is obesogen a good target term to use to identify what you're searching for now?
I think so, yes.
Okay, all right.
Because anyone who writes about chemicals and obesity is going to use that word.
So if you are fat and you are trying to lose weight, then there is no reason to ignore exercise or reduction in diet, but there is no reason to rely upon it for your weight loss either. And
yeah, this is a little bit of a controversial thing, and I'm often quoted incorrectly on this point.
Right.
So what we know from our animal experiments is that if we expose animals prenatally before they're born, to chemicals like tributyltin, they will be reprogrammed the
right.
rest of their life, such that they're predisposed to get fat.
Okay.
What we think, although there's no evidence one way or the other, is that adults who get exposed to similar chemicals, that those effects are unlikely to be permanent.
Oh, okay.
They might be.
All right.
But if you ask me to place my wager,
yeah.
I'm going to place my wager that adult effects are reversible.
Okay. So the change.
Now, if I'm an obese person and I want to lose weight, will just getting rid of chemicals in my life accomplish that? The answer is no.
All right.
You have to modify your diet, change the nature of the foods that you eat, stop following calories in, calories out, and change the nature of the calories that you eat, get more exercise. These things haven't changed.
No.
But the fact is, if you were exposed when your mom was pregnant to a chemical like tributyltin, your battle is harder.
That would account for the recent rise in obesity, too, wouldn't it? Because back in 1950 or 1955, moms weren't dealing with these chemicals to the same extent that we are dealing with them now. And they probably weren't working, most of them. And they probably had less need of processed food or quick food answers that are the cause of the use of these chemicals, eh?
All true stories. And, you know, one of the points that Taubes makes, so you can certainly make an association between the rise in the use of chemicals and plastics with the rise in obesity.
Oh.
The other thing that it correlates with in the United States is at least the war on fat.
Really?
So the government instituted a war on fat in the late 70s.
All right.
And ever since then, we're getting fat as hell.
Yeah. So the war on fat invalidated a look for further causes or further mechanisms or further means of losing weight.
It's all about fat. We eat too much fat, and we exercise too little. And it doesn't matter that the data say otherwise. What matters is that's what's been decided.
Yeah, okay. I get the feeling that you're still battling this bureaucratic elephant in the room, this orthodoxy that is impeding popular acceptance, at any rate, of what you're finding out.
Yeah, it's not... I wouldn't say that I'm battling it because I simply just don't believe the conventional wisdom, and I have enough of a job, you know, doing my own research and trying to do good science and move it forward. And it's not my job to fight that policy battle, but to provide information that people who make policy can use to make good policies if they're so inclined.
Yeah,
and we hope that they are, but history would suggest otherwise.
Oh, okay. So you see an industry role in the proliferation of these chemicals that will may be difficult to counter.
The industry doesn't want to give up use of their chemicals. It's, you know, and now we're finally getting through that BPA is not good, so they've replaced it with BPS, an almost identical compound.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And now they advertise that this bottle is BPA-free.
Oh, I see.
And then that battle will have to be fought all over again.
Really? What do you think would speed this change in industry? Obviously, they need to be more responsible, and we're not asking them to be. And that seems a rather broad request, too. It doesn't seem effective as a war cry.
Yeah, it's a tough question.
Okay.
What I believe is that, sadly, it's never going to happen that we'll be able to legislate the use of these chemicals out of existence.
Okay.
So as a result, I and many of my colleagues are participating in this new field called green chemistry.
All right.
And we're working together with green chemists to help them to design chemicals, plastics, packaging materials that are inherently safe.
Oh.
And then let the market decide. If I'm manufacturing bottles, am I going to pick bottles that may have endocrine disruptors in them, or am I going to pick bottles made out of a material that probably doesn't have endocrine disruptors? So I think by providing an alternative, it's probably the likeliest way to get these bad actors off the market.
Well, and it'll probably come down to status in the end. If the people who are better off than you are buying these bottles that are not endocrine disrupting, then they just simply from the evidence of their purchases, they must be better off. And so if you want to be better off or appear better off, you should buy these too. And then the side effect is that you all get healthier.
But having said that, we already have bottles that are non-endocrine disrupting. We've had them for years. They're called glass.
Yeah, right. and they don't, they're not popular, I guess, because of their shipping weight, for one thing.
Yeah,
and they need to recycle
break.
Them.
I mean, first job I ever had in the supermarket when I was a kid was mopping up the broken glass from people knocking them off shelves.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess we can expect an evolution of the glass bottle, too, until some some radical alternative.
Yeah, someone made an unbreakable glass bottle. That would be the end of the plastic industry, I hope.
That's an interesting thought. Okay, there you go. If you're looking for a job in this new economy, you can create the unbreakable glass bottle, and you can retire a multi-billionaire.
We also have those, too, though. We call them stainless steel.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And they're very popular as water bottles.
Yep. Be sure you don't buy the ones that are lined with, plastic.
Yeah, BPA and so forth. I appreciate that advice. So you mentioned earlier three things that the CBC dealt with. Have we dealt with those three things? What you're sure of, what you suspect, and what you need more information on?
Well, what we're sure of is that there are chemicals that when animals are exposed cause those animals to become predisposed to gain weight.
Right.
We know, at least in some cases, that those effects are permanent. They last throughout the animal's life.
Right.
We need to know a lot more about the mechanism of action.
Okay.
Than we know. We need to know a lot more about to what extent are people exposed. There is very little information on the exposure levels of populations to many of these chemicals.
Yeah.
And in order to know what's the magnitude of the risk, we need to know that.
Yeah, you also need to know what's the effect of the different levels of exposure, which has been subject of some
argument. Otherwise, you have industry on one side saying there's no risk, and you have guys like me saying there is a risk, and we need to know how big is the risk.
Yeah, that's right. That's what you get is people in the middle saying, okay, right. You say there's none, you say there is. How much do I have to worry about this?
Well, but what I always say is, I don't know, I can't tell you whether the risk is small or catastrophic, but I can tell you that the benefit is zero.
Okay.
Okay, so the benefit of exposing yourself to endocrine disrupting chemicals is zero. There is no benefit whatsoever.
Okay.
So if there's no benefit and there's some amount of risk, be it small or be it large, you have to make a decision about, given my finances and my lifestyle, to what extent can I get these chemicals out of my life?
Interesting. Yeah.
Knowing that there is a benefit to being rid of them and no benefit to having them.
Probably a sweeping change in lifestyle attached to getting rid of what we know about now, let alone what we're going to find out in the next few years.
I wouldn't say sweeping change, but you can certainly do many things.
Okay.
Right? You can minimize plastic in your life. That's a good thing.
Okay.
You can minimize canned processed foods.
Okay.
That's a good thing.
Okay.
You know, eating healthy, fresh food, preferably organic, but at least fresh,
okay,
is always better than eating packaged canned food full of salt and full of whatever came from the packaging material.
Yeah.
I have this debate with my daughter when I say, that's not good to eat, don't eat that. She'll say, how do you know that, Papa?
How old
look
is she?
She's 15 now.
All right.
I say, look at the list of ingredients. If there's more than, when your mom makes a cake, she puts in, flour and sugar and salt and butter. And look at this cake here. It has 200 ingredients.
Oh, okay.
Do you really think that that's good for you?
Yeah. And what does your daughter say?
She grudgingly accepts that, but she's...
Well, she's
why about everything.
Probably a good bellwether for the population at large.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, okay. There you go. There's an experiment you don't have to run. All right. All right. Was there anything else that you wanted to say about this before we close the interview? And thank you for your time.
No, I think that the main point that I want to make is that chemicals can affect the way we respond to calories. But if you're exposed to chemicals, you are not doomed to get fat.
Okay.
It just means that if you've been exposed, and we don't know whether you've been exposed or not, it means that your battle may be harder.
All right.
And if you're a person who, eats well and exercises and struggles to lose that weight,
yeah,
there's a possibility that it's the way your metabolism has been programmed.
Oh.
And to some extent that's genetic, and to some extent that's the result of what you were exposed to during your early life.
Yeah. Okay.
And you can modify that. Everyone can lose weight if they try hard enough.
Okay. Much appreciated, that encouragement. I'm overweight myself. I know there are a lot of
people. I am too.
Yeah, I know there are a lot of people who are very visibly overweight and would really look for another angle on the task of losing.
I think those people should stop following the conventional wisdom that you need to eat all these grains a day.
Yeah.
They should read Gary Tobbs's book.
All right.
And learn that carbohydrate is the enemy.
Right.
And take steps accordingly.
And Tobbs's book again was called?
Good Calories, Bad Calories.
All right. Thanks. Well, why don't we end on that? That's a good recommendation.
Yeah, I'd like to say, you know, minimize exposure to environmental chemicals that you get in your food and personal care products.
Yeah.
Eat the best, healthiest food that you can.
Yeah.
And exercise as much as you're able.
Mm-hmm.
And you're likely to be much better off than if you don't do those things.
Thank you, Dr. Blumberg.
You're welcome.
I very much appreciate your time. We peppered the interview with descriptions of how busy you are and how little you have time for things. I hope exposing your interview to the many interested people will have some effect.
Well, I hope so. And if you could send me a link to the story when you eventually do it, that would be great.
Thank you again. And I guess now you're going back to work.
Now I'm going back to work, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For our listener, we did the interview at 8:15 on a weekday night. That was 5:15 for Dr. Blumberg. And yes, with or without a supper, when the interview is done at 5:45, he's going back to work. You've heard it before on Disrespect, but I couldn't resist playing it for you again. Susie Vinnick, the Oreo Cookie Blues.
I got some chocolate on my fingers, icing on my lips, sugar toppings. I got way too much blubber on my hips. I keep the nightlight burning in the kitchen, baby, so I can go downstairs and cruise. I got them covered cream filled cookie blues. Whoa, oh, I hide them in a cabinet. I keep them in a jar. And for emergencies, I keep them in the glove compartment of my car. You know, I can't live without them. Oh, no. They get me high.
Pushing up a whole bunch of daisies, girl, and quite frankly, I kind of think that you're sick. I can't live without them, oh no. I don't want to lose. I got them Oreo cream sandwich, chocolate covered cream filled cookie, built by Nabisco, and you knew they. I got the next best thing to Nookie. Blues, Mr. Christie, you just don't compare. Oh, no.
And now it's time for Disrespect's review of the news. These aren't the articles that we read to you. These are The article is adapted for radio. The authors of the articles are mentioned along with the newspapers when we read them on the air. The star attraction at the Federal Liberal Convention this month was Premier Dalton McGuinty, sources say. McGuinty, who has been courted to lead the Troubled Party, was the keynote speaker on the Friday night of the biennial four-day Ottawa confab. The Premier led the Ontario Liberals to a third consecutive election victory on October 6 and will share some of his secrets to rebuilding a political party and then winning against the odds. But any federal Liberals hoping to woo McGuinty into succeeding interim leader Bob Rae during the January 12th to 15th Roadmap to Renewal event were disappointed. "People see our success and they're asking me about leading the federal party," he told a provincial Liberal conference last month. "So I want you to know I love my country, but I am committed to my province and my party." After that November 26 speech in Niagara Falls, McGuinty, leader of the party since 1996, explained that he wanted to clear the air about any federal aspirations. "There's a little bit of an undercurrent out there which keeps getting back to me, and some of the folks around me thought it was important to shut the door once and for all." He blamed his brother, Ottawa South MP David McGuinty, for fueling leadership rumors by suggesting he was the best man to rebuild the National Party despite his dearth of personality or charm. At the time, McGuinty, eldest son in the family of 10 children, jokingly chided his kid brother. "He's going to have to sit at the little card table at the Christmas dinner. He's not going to sit at the dining room table with the rest of us." McGuinty has proved to be remarkably resilient politically. Public opinion polls last summer suggested progressive conservative leader Tim Hudak had a double-digit lead in popularity and would coast to the premier's office. But McGuinty and a veteran campaign team defied naysayers and bested Hudak and NDP leader Andrea Horvath with a disciplined, almost flawless campaign. That was adapted from an article in the Toronto Star by Robert Benzie, the Queen's Park Bureau Chief. In case you were thinking of voting for the federal Liberals in the next election, the party that gave us collection of seniors' pensions by the CRA. At the end of March, the Ontario Medical Association's current contract will expire. That gives the deficit-plagued government of Dalton McGuinty one of its best opportunities to rein in soaring health costs by targeting the roughly $10 billion it spends annually on doctors. It will require structural changes to the way doctors go about their jobs, changes that would directly affect how doctors interact with their patients. Based on conversations with government and health sector sources, here are some of the key areas the government will be trying to target. Fewer fees, more service. The province will continue trying to get more family doctors away from fee-for-service, but that won't do much good if it doesn't get better value out of family health teams, which a majority of doctors have already moved toward because the Liberals provided financial incentives to do so. Liberals now concede that because they didn't do enough in previous negotiations to ensure doctors make themselves available to their patients, including through after-hours services, it hasn't worked as well as hoped. They'll now seek to rectify that, arguing that doctors and family health teams are being overpaid for what they currently deliver. Rationing care. Understandably, people who spent much of their lives studying medicine don't appreciate politicians or bureaucrats telling them how to do their jobs. But the Liberals will try to engage doctors themselves in writing new rules or guidelines. Unlike some other potential reforms, this one could create a public backlash if it appears the government is skimping on some common treatments. Easier, faster, cheaper? Government is criticized for paying very high fees to specialists for procedures that were once long and difficult and are now quicker and more routine. Cataract surgery is the most common example, but cardiology and radiology also come up. But it's unlikely that the Ontario Medical Association, which faces strong pressures from within, will just throw some of its members under the bus. As a result, it may go along with reduced fees for certain procedures only if the doctors who perform them get additional compensation in some other form. reconnecting with hospitals. A familiar argument to be repeated in economist Don Drummond's much-hyped report on public services is that there is too big a gulf between primary care and hospitals. A partial solution to ensure information about patients is shared between the two sides is electronic medical records. On that front, the government dropped the ball and is still playing catch-up. But there's concern that too many doctors have withdrawn from hospital duty as well, in some cases leaving emergency rooms and other facilities understaffed. That could prove a much more controversial topic if the government tries to force new requirements. And where, if at all, the doctor will see you? Going to the doctor's office won't become a thing of the past, but the province might try to get Ontarians going there less often. One way would be encouraging more interaction with patients via telephone or email, particularly for follow-up. The key here would be to get doctors who are still on fee-for-service to accept lower rates for that form of service. As well, there's the commitment the Liberals made during the campaign to get doctors to make more house calls. There's arguably a savings component here as well if it helps to keep seniors living in their homes rather than needing long-term care. That by Adam Radwanski in Tuesday, January 17th, Globe and Mail. Finance Canada tell us that we should be thanking the government because they're not going to be raising payroll taxes as much as they promised, said Derek Fildebrand, National Research Director for Canadian Taxpayers Federation. If you get a rate of inflation pay increase, you're going to be effectively paying more income tax than you otherwise would, said Fildebrand, noting the federal tax brackets will be adjusted by 2.8%, whereas the Ontario inflation rate is 3.3%. The Conservative government included a flurry of tax credits in the last federal budget that could bring a bit of relief to some Canadians. Adults with children who share a home but are not married or in a common law relationship, such as roommates or two sisters living in the same house, will now be able to claim separate child tax credits. Parents will get a 15% credit on up to $500 they spend on enrolling their children younger than 16 in artistic, cultural, recreational, or developmental activity programs. The tax credit, a maximum of $75, must be used for membership or registration fees and not for equipment. Meanwhile, the corporate tax rate is going down to 15%. The new year will also bring more flexibility when it comes to retirement as the next phase of changes to the Canada Pension Plan, meant to encourage people to retire later on in life, will come into effect. All workers aged 60 to 64 will be required to continue making contributions to the CPP, even if they are already receiving a pension. And they will no longer have to stop working or reduce their salaries in order to start receiving benefits. Those aged 65 to 69 will have the option to continue contributing to the CPP to be matched by their employer as a way to increase pensions down the road. If they do not want to contribute after they turn 65, they will need to give notice to their employers and the Canada Revenue Agency. Families with ailing relatives will be eligible for 15% of the maximum $2,000 a year, up to $300. That they can claim in expenses related to ill and dependent relatives. Government also removed the $10,000 limit on medical expenses for disabled dependents that are eligible for a 15% tax credit. There are other changes worth noting. Stamps will soon cost 2 cents more, with the price of mailing a basic letter within Canada rising to 61 cents on January 16th. And that by Joanna Smith in the Ottawa Bureau of the Toronto Star. Environmentalists are fearful the Conservative government is planning to limit their advocacy role after Prime Minister Stephen Harper complained that groups flush with foreign money are undermining a controversial pipeline review. The Conservative-dominated Commons Finance Committee is set to begin a review of the charity sector, and several activists say government MPs have told business groups that the committee will look at the environmental sector's transparency, its advocacy role, and the flow of funds from outside the country. James Rajot, chair of the Commons Finance Committee, said the study is aimed at finding ways to make Canadians give more to charity. Mr. Rajat said he couldn't prejudge where things will go, noting the review hasn't even begun yet. He said any recommendations the committee makes would affect all charities. The whole view that this is a way of taking funding away, that's not it at all, he said. And you don't make a recommendation as a committee targeting one set of charities. You make a recommendation that would apply to all charities. But John Bennett, executive director of the Sierra Club of Canada, isn't reassured. I'm quite convinced that we're the next on the hit list of this government that doesn't know how to find compromises but only bully people, Mr. Bennett said. On the charitable status, we could have some significant challenges. He added that he is concerned that the statements the Tories have made are intended to prepare the ground for a crackdown on environmental groups. An official at a national organization who asked not to be identified for fear of retribution said activists have been told of conversations in which conservative MPs speak of their eagerness to clip the wings of environmental organizations. Currently, charitable groups are limited in their political activities within the boundaries established by the Income Tax Act and a federal court ruling, as well as the Canada Revenue Agency's interpretations of these two standards. They can pursue nonpartisan political activity that is directly related to their primary charitable objectives and does not account for more than 10% of their overall budget. They can also pursue educational activities so long as they are balanced and informative rather than emotional in nature. Lawyers that work in the charitable sector say it would be difficult for the government to restrict the activity of the environmental groups without sideswiping others. And that from a story in the Globe and Mail, Sean McCarthy and Stephen Chase in Ottawa. Same-sex marriage trap. The Harper government has served notice that thousands of same-sex couples who have flocked to Canada from abroad since 2004 to get married are not legally wed. The reversal of federal policy is revealed in a document filed in a Toronto test case launched recently by a lesbian couple seeking a divorce. Wed in Toronto in 2005, the couple have been told they cannot divorce because they were never really married. A Department of Justice lawyer says their marriage is not legal in Canada since they could not have lawfully wed in Florida or England, where the two partners reside. The government's hard line has cast sudden doubt on the rights and legal status of couples who wed in Canada after a series of court decisions opened the floodgates to same-sex marriage. The mechanics of determining issues such as tax status, employment benefits, and immigration have been thrown into legal limbo. The latest development threatens to transform Canada from an international beacon for the rights of gays and lesbians to a nation that discriminates against them, said Martha McCarthy, a prominent Toronto lawyer who represents the couple. Evan Wolfson, president of a New York gay rights group, Freedom to Marry, said the federal position will be a major embarrassment for Canada internationally. He said it is too early to predict what effects the move may have on child custody, spousal support, or asset division for estranged same-sex couples who were married in Canada. One of the benefits that marriage gives to families is security and clarity, Mr. Wolfson said. Beyond the financial implications, Mrs. McCarthy said, same-sex couples have looked to marriage to provide a sense of inclusion. They returned home with marriage certificates that they got on their wedding day showing everybody they were legally married, she said. They gave them to their employers, their benefits people, and all kinds of other third parties, and Canada participated in that. Their divorce application will be considered next month by an Ontario Superior Court judge. They are asking the judge to either craft an exemption allowing them to divorce or to strike down any legislative provision that has the effect of preventing them from doing so. Ms. McCarthy said California, which recently faced a similar problem, passed a law recognizing the validity of same-sex marriages involving non-residents so they could obtain divorces. That's exactly what we could do here, she said. And that's all the news for Disrespect this week. Come back, there may be more. Courtesy of another host, this hit. Sounds like it should be on Dusted Off, 6 o'clock on Monday nights here. Sam Cooke, Somebody Have Mercy.
And fellas that make me feel good, just put it right back. Somebody have mercy, tell me what is wrong with me. Oh, help me right now. Somebody have mercy, baby. I wanna know what is wrong with me. Oh, yeah.
somebody have mercy. I wanna know what is wrong with me. I don't know what it is, baby, but I feel good. Somebody have mercy. I wanna know what is wrong with me. Oh yeah. Sometimes I don't know how I stand the thing that woman do to me. But let me tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm going down to the bus station, baby, with a suitcase in my hand. Can you imagine me carrying one of them suitcases? I'm going down to the bus station, baby, with a suitcase in my hand. Oh, yes, I am. I'ma grab me an armful of Greyhound and ride just as far as I can. Now, come on, blow that thing for me now. Tell you what I'm doing, baby. Listen to me right now. I'm standing here wondering, baby, will a matchbox hold my clothes? Oh, yes, I am. I said, I'm standing here wondering, baby, will a cotton picking matchbox hold my clothes? Oh, yes, I am. I got such a long way to get there and such a short time to go. Oh, blowing one more time. Somebody somewhere, somebody somewhere, somebody, somebody have mercy. I wanna know what is wrong with me. It ain't that leukemia, that ain't it. Sometimes I don't know how. Oh yeah, let me do that one more time. Ah, somebody somewhere, somebody somewhere, somebody somewhere, somebody have mercy. Tell me what is wrong with me. Oh, yeah. Sometimes I don't know how I stand the thing that gonna do to me. Somebody have mercy on me.
This is Jeff Langhorne of Disrespect Radio. I think you're here instead of listening to commercial radio because you want to. Well, something funny, I'm here because I want to, too. All our hosts on community radio are unpaid volunteers. Our management takes less than scale, so they must want to, too. Our guests, they have to want to as well. They're not looking for the big endorsement. They're not looking for big bucks. They're here because they want to talk to you, the CFMU listener. We're simulcast around the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're also podcast back 6 or 7 years at this time. We're archived at radioforall.net. That's the number for, not the word, radioforall.net. You can reach the show at disrespect@lycos.com. Come back at showtime next week on CFMU 93.3 on your radio at 12 noon on Thursdays. You know you want to.